I'm Tom Rowe at Wave Farm, today introducing radio theater, and we have a special treat. Morton Feldman says Robert Ashley from an April 9th, 2011 WGXC broadcast performed by Bill Hellerman and Max Goldfarb. Hellerman and Goldfarb perform Robert Ashley's Morton Feldman Says live in WGXC's Hudson studio on April 9th, 2011. Wave Farm Executive Director Galen Joseph Hunter introduces the broadcast and asks a few questions afterward.
Hi, Max, and hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Should I start?
You may start. Yes, please.
Well, I'm here to do a piece by Robert Ashley called Morton Feldman Says. Robert Ashley is very important American composer now, I think in his 80s, but was the wild man of new music at one point in the 60s with a very famous festival out in Michigan called the Once Festival, along with Alvin Lucier and Gordon Mumma. And in 1964, he sat down with Morton Feldman, who was the part of the triumvirate of new music, Cage, Feldman, and Brown, from the 50s. And they had a conversation, and Bob taped it, which in those days was a pretty unusual thing. Very few people had tape recorders, and they were, I can speak from personal experience, fraught with mishap. At any rate, he got a tape, and at some point a few years later, Morty, I knew Morton Feldman, so I call him Morty. Morty was asked to submit an article to, I think it was Transition magazine. Turns out it was Culture magazine, but I think he told me Transition. And he didn't want to write an article. So he asked Bob to transcribe the conversation we had had, which, again, in those days they didn't have the equipment they have today for doing transcription. So it was an arduous task with turning the the tape recorder on and off, rewinding, finding the spot, writing it down, and etc. Well, Bob figured that he was really interested in human voice, spoken voice, as a musical instrument, as a musical source. And he had done all this work, so he would make it a piece, which he called Morton Feldman Says. And this is from a conversation in 1964. The requirement for the piece is that it be done by a composer. I am a composer. And memorized. And that there he did interject an interviewer with his name on it, but it can be done by anybody. And it will be done today by Max Goldfarb, who will ask questions occasionally in what was essentially a monologue by Morton Feldman. Shall we start?
Absolutely.
Okay. During the past few years, I'm continually reminded of Peggy's remark, everything begins as a mystique and ends in politics. It seems that about 10 or 15 years after something new and original is done and has its first impact, that impact becomes a political one. That is to say, by the time the young composer gets in touch with a particular work, it is already in a power struggle with other works and other ideas. The intention, the aesthetic of the work may be a complete mystery to this young composer, but in the form of politics, it's not a mystery. It's very concrete. So, what does the young composer do? He becomes a revisionist. We know from history that it is the revisionist who takes things from that mysterious region of originality and gives those things a man-made rationale. It was true of Christ. Same thing with Luther. What was pure, for example, in the ancient Hebrew belief, was too mysterious for many people. It came from a divine being. It wasn't human. Christ made it human. With Luther, it became even more human. I mean, that the human being comes in and makes a synthesis, which he can work with comfortably, a concrete synthesis. And so what happens is that the original, that which was pure, that which was like nature, that which didn't seem to reflect the human point of view, is cast aside, or rather, to be more precise, is incorporated by the revisionist mind. Stockhausen is the perfect example of the revisionist mind in music. His whole attitude to the work that we have done is really not unlike Toynbee's evaluation of history seen through a Christian bias, that the Jews are a fossil race. I'm quite sure that Stockhausen feels that chance is now a fossil aesthetic. But then, I must not even use the word aesthetic. Remember that the revisionists do not see chance as an aesthetic. They see it as a process that they must humanize and present only in a very portentous technical fashion. This, of course, is done without any aesthetic goals in mind. That the revisionist wants to do is make a political impact. The revisionist wants power. It is in the nature of a revisionist to want power. It is in the nature of a revisionist to start a school. It is in the nature of a revisionist to want to convert. The revisionists are fanatics. But what they're fanatic about is always amazing to me, because they've created nothing new.
So how does this change from aesthetics to politics affect you? That is, when you began working, if I understand your analogy, your concern was primarily aesthetic, but now that your aesthetic has become one of the ingredients in the political struggle, how does this affect your work?
I find that the only way I can work today is not to think of the present, but only to think of the past of my own life, where I worked without being conscious of the ramifications of my own actions in the world. I certainly don't want to create the impression by those religious analogies that I think I was some sort of deity. But there was a deity in my life, and that was sound. Everything else was after the fact. All realization was after the fact. Process was after the fact. Of course, what happens in the world when your work starts to become well known is that you have to justify it. You have to make some sort of rationale. And even the most banal rationale is accepted, welcomed by people who should know better. For example, in some of my music, I leave the rhythmic situation quite free. That is, there are variable degrees of slowness, and the performer has freedom of duration. Several years ago, I mentioned to a very renowned colleague that in a certain piece, I had made a metronome marking of between 40 and 70, which is still relatively slow. And it was surprising how relieved this brilliant man was.
You mean that to rationalize your art puts it into the political struggle? Certainly most composers are aware of chance now, and a lot of recent music uses chance to some fashion, to some degree, combined with other ideas. This, I guess, would be revisionist music. Most of it does seem sick. I mean, ailing without conviction. The composers seem uncertain about just why they are using chants. In quoting Peggy, do you mean that when a musical idea like chants gets to be part of the political struggle, its value really ends?
Well, that's what happens when a composer gets caught up in the political struggle. The whole temperament of this period is basically an academic one. Academic because it is based on other people's work. That alone makes it academic. For me, there's no difference between the extreme mechanistic writing of Milton Babbitt and the extreme compulsive writing of Lamont Young. The reason that music is ailing is that everybody is still following the same historical process, that Malraux idea that art comes from art. Now, anybody who was around in the early 50s with the painters saw that these men had started to explore their own sensibilities, their own plastic language, each one very different. It's almost laughable when you read the criticism of the work of those days, when they were all lumped together as the New York School. Actually, the thing that made it a school was a powerful, mysterious idea. That is, they all searched within their own sensibilities for those energies, for everything connected with the painting. Now again, a few years later, what the young people all started to take from the work was its most superficial mannerisms, its brushstrokes, that which they thought was calligraphy, that which they thought were objects, which weren't objects. They started to build on the work of these people with what they could recognize as technical achievements. Now, never before was there a movement as fresh and new as the abstract painting of the 50s, that complete independence from other art, that complete inner security to work with that which was unknown to them. That was a fantastic accomplishment, especially as they weren't revolutionaries. They didn't want to bury the past. To be oneself, as well as art, that was the thing. I feel very close to that particular spirit. We didn't exchange intellectual ideas. Ideas didn't make the work. Unfortunately, for most people who pursue art, ideas become their opium. The sickness that you feel about the situation today is a piling up of multitudinous suggestions and multitudinous misconceptions, each tumbling over the other. There's no security to be oneself. There's only a total insecurity because people don't know who they want to be. This is not only true of the young people. This is true of Boulez. This is true of Stockhausen. You can see this in the way they have approached American chance music. They began by finding rationalizations for how they could incorporate chance and still keep their precious integrity. How can you have integrity when your whole life is based on the accumulation of ideas? Boulez began to work out a complicated schematic situation of systematizing chants by way of Mallarmé and Kafka. He tried to give it a literary justification. Stockhausen talks about science, about all the improbable things that become probable, and about all those things that are justifiably improbable in his work. But this work did not come through science. It didn't come through Kafka and Mallarmé. It came through a completely different world that did not need justification. That is what's important. When I wrote what I wrote, when I write what I write, I do not have to talk about Kafka. I don't want to make it human. I don't have to revise history.
Then in order for the young composer to reach that situation where he doesn't have to justify himself, what direction do you think he should take? What prospects are there for him?
In The Magic Mountain, the last paragraph begins, "If thou livest or diest, thy prospects are poor." I feel that the prospects of the young composer are very, very poor, because all he can salvage, even from the work that he finds important, the work that he actually loves, is the furthering of his technical facility. And the demands on that technical facility are becoming greater and greater. This is the age of Picasso. And we know what Picasso did as a young man. After 15 or 20 years, he started to look at Cézanne and to develop Cubism. What has that got to do with Cézanne? We all say, yes, look at what he learned from Cézanne. In a more crazy way, that is exactly what is happening in music. Look what he's learned from Cage. From Cage? It is Cage. You go to the various festivals and you see fantastic technical equipment. And all the time you know that the young composer has immorally been given the moral license to lead a parasitic life. You find the same thing in the universities. You find it in important centers like Tanglewood, where they're given this immoral basis for a really unproductive life. Quite recently, Lucas Voss tried to get me an appointment. It was for a chair at a large university. When he mentioned my name, the consensus was, yes, he's a very colorful figure, but what can he teach? What the schools and the important pedagogues are doing is just perpetuating a tragic syndrome, a tragic misunderstanding about what it is to be a composer. But then perhaps they don't think of themselves as composers. I think that composing for them is just an incidental activity in the power struggle of ideas. You used the word sick. The word sick is not sick enough. There's a perpetual cultural insanity feeding itself on everything it can use without any feeling of obligation.
What you've said implies, I think, that even if a composer today saw music as a religious calling and chose to keep himself apart from the professional situation and from musical politics, he would still be discovered and discussed and imitated before very long. And worse, he would probably get more publicity for being a religious figure. In other words, the composer today can't go very long without having to contend with his own image.
Well, this is something that Rilke was always running away from. In fact, I think there's a legend that he feigned his death in order to be left in peace to work. It's certainly more in keeping with the temperament of a painter or a poet. But it's something new for the composer to face. He'd better face it, or he's finished.
Amazing. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Max. So in case we have listeners, Bill, that have tuned in midway through this interview, would you mind doing your explanation again for us?
Sure. You've just heard, or heard half of, whatever the case may be, of a performance by myself doing a piece by Robert Ashley called Morton Feldman Says,
and I was doing the voice of Morton Feldman, a friend of mine.
Very well, I imagine. You seem to do it with some authenticity, I think.
Well, thank you very much. I tried. Let me finish the explanation. Yeah. Robert actually had taped in a conversation he had with Morton Feldman back in 1964. And then Morty was asked to provide an article for a magazine and didn't want to write it. So he asked Bob to transcribe the tape, which Bob did. And having done all that work, he decided that he would make a piece out of it. And this is a very, very much part of Bob Ashley's work, is that he's really made a number of great operas based on the spoken voice. And exactly how it can acquire musicality in mm-hmm. various ways. And so this was an early example of his concern with spoken human voice as a musical instrument, so to speak.
Right.
So
so you said 1964.
Yeah, this is 1964.
Do you, you're a composer who's been working for how long, would you say?
Oh, about 40 years, I guess.
So with that perspective, would you, first of all, do you agree with Morton Feldman's assessment of the state of the young composer? I guess you were a young composer when he authored this.
Yeah, actually, I was a very young composer when that was going on. In fact, I arrived in New York in 62 and with my guitar and my cat set on actually not being a composer, but I was originally a flamenco guitarist in the village.
Oh, wow.
My name was Guillermo Brillante, which is a literal translation of William Hellerman into Spanish. And so at that time, I was just beginning to compose. And ironically, I wound up by tremendous, unbelievable good fortune studying with Stefan Volpe, who was teacher of Morton Feldman, which had a lot to do with Marty and I becoming friends. But it is an interesting, as I'm doing the piece, I'm aware of, on the one hand, how awkward, let's say, it must be for people today to realize what a deal it was, chance,
right,
and chance music. And Cage has had a tremendous impact, I think, in all the arts. And his ideas of chance are one thing. And I think Morty made it pretty clear that he felt it wasn't so much the idea of chance, but that Cage, in his writings, it's so clear that he lived a whole kind of Zen acceptance of randomness,
mm-hmm.
acceptance of rejoicing in the way things are, and rejection of the obsession with making everything better.
Right.
And that... And what an impact this had on many American as well. He's focusing on Europeans, Boulez and Stockhausen, because mm-hmm. they were the dominant leaders. And I think you can sense a defensiveness in the tone of the piece I just did.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And that somehow or another, on the one hand, that basically the main point is that they missed the point,
right,
in his opinion.
Right.
And that he really lets them have it with both barrels. But at the same time, it's, Morty's very much of an intellectual himself.
Yeah, yeah.
As the quotes reveal. And he's very, I guess you would say, a very well-grounded in a European framework.
Mm-hmm.
He's quoting Rilke.
Exactly.
Peggy, whom I don't think anybody listening today has probably heard of. And, well, maybe they have. I shouldn't be that presumptuous. But he's not a major figure.
Yeah, I don't know him.
He's a French sociologist, a political science, I think. Okay. Scientist, you might call him today. But at any rate, it's still pertinent, I think, in a strange way, is because of the dynamic of that he starts off with, of what do you take from the past?
Right.
And the minute you're doing that consciously, you are, in some sense of the term, caught up in the power struggle, a political power struggle.
Yeah. Well, of course, I'm listening, I'm thinking obsessively about these ideas and this conversation in the context of what we're trying to do here on the station in terms of transmission arts, and also as an arts organization that's trying to really cultivate and define this and authenticate this as a contemporary art genre. And we have this book coming out that's tracing a genealogy. And so there is this sort of focus on the past, I think, in terms of creating evidence for the genre. But there's something else that's so inevitably present about the idea of transmission art and being on the airwaves and the kind of ephemerality of that, the transientness of that, that I sort of felt like, okay, I can agree with Feldman and, you know, the artists who are working within the context of transmission, he wouldn't be so critical of, I think.
Well, you know, it's an interesting, you know, area for discussion you bring up, because, and I was thinking of that myself, it's the bias that is going on in this conversation in 64 is so clearly still rooted in the notion of music as something written on a piece of paper that, you know, is a composition. I mean, of course, people are aware of jazz and, you know, various things that are improvisational, often thought of later on as real-time composition, a word trying to clarify the fact that they're not random, you know, improvisatory in the sense of grasping at straws.
Right.
Which sometimes.
Sometimes, yes.
Sometimes, yes. Morty wasn't that involved, but Bob certainly was with electronic and media and stuff. And that, I mean, now it seems so anachronistic to even be talking about a musical score.
Yeah.
That somehow I just don't really think the, you know, energies are there, even among many people of, you know, my generation.
Or in terms of conventional ideas of musical score. I think there is this kind of obsession of the idea of score and revisiting what that can mean, which is sort of interesting.
Well, in my own work, I mean, I actually I don't know how you would put it, but perhaps by accident launched the term sound art, because I curated the first, you know, sculpture show of sound art in the city and used the term. It seemed like a natural to me. Actually, I guess, you know, ironically derived from Tonkunst, which is the German, you know, literal translation back into German. And it just made perfect sense. And that I also was very, at that time, still am actually, but very concerned that everybody, the group of people in the show, were not composers, all of them. Some were visual artists, some were poets, and that, you know, some of it was sound tech, some of it was audio art. These terms are all bandied about, and they can often overlap and intersect in various ways. And that, of course, it was a sculpture show, so the objects were involved. But, you know, somebody like Les Levine had a, I thought, very beautiful piece. You know, it's like a medicine cabinet, like you would find in a bathroom on the wall with various things in it. In a mirror, and when you walked up in front of it, it said, "You're beautiful. You look terrific. You're just wonderful." And it was, you know, it's not like music, but it is.
Yeah.
And it was such a excellent example among many of, you know, how artists could use sound if they weren't just limited by thinking that, you know, sound is, I mean, art is something that's on a two-dimensional surface.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.